The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Croner from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with an article that's considered to be in the national interest, and it is. And it starts with a picture. Well, first I'll give you the title. I think Black History Month should last all year. And there's a picture of several renowned black people, Harriet Tubman, I should know these names, I don't. There's a bunch of them. My apologies, I should know the name, but here they are. Black History Month honors not only famous Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, that's who I could remember, Paul Robeson, Serena Williams, George Washington Carver, Thurgood Marshall, and everyday black people as well. We know about Harriet Tubman and Martin Luther King Jr., of course, but our American history lesson skipped over so many other African-American achievers. How true. This is by Dawn Porter. My feelings of Black History Month are complicated. On one hand, I deeply appreciate the time to intentionally celebrate the brilliant contributions to American culture and history by people who look like me. But while absolutely worthy of celebration, the stories of African-American contribution to our society have become repetitive over the years. Harriet Tubman was so brave. Martin Luther King Jr. was the best orator of all time. George Washington Carver was sure a whiz when peanuts. Year after year, I hear dutiful recitation, my apologies, my tongue today isn't working, of the same familiar facts, and I fear the result is the mistaken impression that this is the sum total of African Americans' role in our history. Confining the history of the entire race of people to a 28-day period not only diminishes the significance of their contribution, but also allows the greater truth to be erased. When I ask my African American friends about this, I often hear some version of, I'd rather have 1 month than no months. But is that the only choice? Black History Month traces its origins back to 1926, when the Association for the Study of African American Life and History designated a week in February chosen to coincide with the birthdays of Abraham Lincoln, February 12th, and Frederick Douglass, February 14th, I didn't know that, as what was then called Negro History Week. The creation of that week was an important historical marker. Its founder, Carter Woodson, an African-American historian, intended for black history to be taught as part of the American history and looked forward to the day when a designated period would no longer be needed. At that time, although it had been half a century since the abolition of slavery, black people were still strenuously making the argument for their humanity. There is nothing so motivated as knowing that people who look like you achieve great things. I know this from experience. My grandmother's name before she married was Marion Robeson. She was the daughter of Benjamin Robeson, a minister and civil rights activist. Some of his more famous brother, Paul Robeson, the scholar, activist, and entertainer, remembered for his performance of Old Man River and Showboat. What a beautiful voice that man has. Their father, my great-great-grandfather, William Drew Robeson, was a slave in North Carolina. He escaped to Philadelphia via the Underground Railroad. During the Civil War, he fought with the Union Army, and in 1876, this child of slavery graduated from Lincoln College with a degree in theology and then became a minister. My great-grandfather was one of his seven children. Before she died, my grandmother shared with me her father's sermons. In them, my great-grandfather, also a veteran, spoke eloquently about his love for a country that opposed his civil rights efforts. I first read this moving writings when I was in law school, at a time when I began to let feelings of self-doubt creep into my consciousness. In this hyper-competitive world, I began to think that perhaps I wasn't quite as smart as I thought I was, wasn't quite as capable. Reading his words pushed me to think about how the full story of the accomplishments of black people is so buried that we think of those we do celebrate as exceptional. I learned racism teaches that there can't possibly be so much black excellence that the accomplished black person must be an outlier. And then I discovered Ida B. Wells. Orphaned as a teenager, she went on to become a journalist, a mother, and an activist. She worked alongside Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and pushed them to include black women in her cause for suffrage. The story of the women's suffrage movement is absolutely incomplete without understanding the efforts of Wells and her black compatriots. Full stop. Reading her words made history feel real for me, so painful but also so celebratory. Today, As a documentary filmmaker, I think of her fearless crusade for truth often, and I'm motivated to continue to tell important stories. My most recent reminder of the power of the story was my work directing film about Representative John Lewis called Good Trouble. I spent a year interviewing him and traveling the country with him, watching hours of footage of a young Lewis strategizing and organizing, watching him deftly work with white and black activists and politicians. I lived history through his eyes and experiences. Walking through an airport with a congressman, I was constantly struck by the fact that he could not go more than a few feet without somebody asking for a picture or to shake his hand. He always stopped and acknowledged and thanked the person. It was as if he sealed each interaction with an implicit understanding that every person he connected with would become an ambassador, and that when they tell the story of John Lewis, it will assure that history lives on, even now after his passing. Because of my work and my interests and experiences, I am acutely aware of the need for accurate information in our media and our history books. Don't we need this information all year long? In 1976, the week that had been set aside to honor black accomplishments was expanded to a month and called Black History Month. In the preceding 50 years, remarkable battles had been hard fought and won, including landmark Supreme Court cases that resulted in the 1954 decision in Brown versus the Board of Education, requiring the desegregation of public schools, the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965, and other civil rights laws, guaranteeing basic rights of full citizenship to all people, regardless of their race. So now, some 40 years later, it's time for black history to enter the next phase. African Americans no longer need to argue that we deserve equal rights. With the establishment of the glorious National Museum of African American History and Culture on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., we no longer need to make the case that our contributions are worthy of noting and celebrating. And there's a picture of Dawn Porter, very attractive African-American lady. But racism and discrimination on the basis of race continue to be a stain on our country, and only by telling true stories do we have a chance to eradicate not only racist behavior, but also racist thought. We have to face head-on the untrue idea that only white people contribute substantially to our country's cultural, scientific, legal, and other advances. To dismantle this false narrative, the first place we should look is the story we tell about ourselves. I am confident that given the opportunity, a host of scholars would gladly take a pen to outdated history books, break them apart, and add the rich content that includes the contributions of not only African Americans, but Native and Asian people, women, and every other marginalized group. History is not a pie. My having more does not leave you less. I'm a plus, and a person. I think we need Black History Month. I also think we should challenge our educators and ourselves to consistently search out and share stories and facts that expand our understanding of history to include all who play a role in it. Acknowledging that America is a multicultural society and that the accomplishments and contributions of people who are not white are real, substantial, and important is proof that the American ideals so many of us profess to value are real. I asked my friend, the noted historian and scholar Henry Louis Gates, Jr., for his thoughts on this matter, to which he quickly replied, "Every day should be Black History Month." Yes, sir, every day. Inspiration. A Valentine's Day lesson. As a child, I had a humiliating experience on February 14th. Many of us have had that. Now that I'm a teacher, my students celebrate the day with love. "I'm going to tell you a story," I tell my class of high school seniors. All eyes look up, nothing quiets, a chatty group of teenagers fastened, causes them to put down their phones and more effectively than a promise of a story. It's a tale about love and heartbreak. I pause for dramatic effect and humiliation. Their eyes widen. I add the clincher, "Mine." Now I have them. This is a story I've told every February since I started teaching in 1999. Its power lies, I think, in how it changes the way my students see me. Gone temporarily is whatever omnipotence I command as their teacher. Left behind is an 11-year-old girl whose feelings are crushed, and each of them is outraged by the brutality of the one who did the crushing. In sixth grade, I fell madly in love. His name was David. He was tall, cute, kind of a bad boy, which I found tantalizing. He had no interest in me at all, but I doodled his name all over my diary, wrote DT loves MM, no giant hearts. You get the idea. They got the idea. The girls are laughing and remembering. So it was Valentine's Day, elementary school style. Construction paper, mailboxes, someone's mom brought in cupcakes. Our parents brought those variety pack Valentines to send to everyone in class. Dreadful things with corning sayings like, "Be my honey," spelled B-E-E, and "I go for you." All of them are laughing now. It was party day. I spilled my cards onto my desk amid many small envelopes. I saw one enormous one, spangled with glitter. My mind raced. Wow. Someone likes me enough to buy me this giant Valentine? Who could it be from? With trembling hands, I tore open the envelope and drew out a sparkly image of a queen seated on her throne. The heading read, "To a Queen of Valentine." I give the class a meaningful look. I was swooning with excitement. Slowly, I turned the Valentine over and at the bottom saw the signature and almost faded. David. It was all too perfect to be real. Then my eyes traveled up to the writing above the signature. In large, uneven letters, he had written me a special message. My students leaned in, waiting. You could hear a pin drop. It read, "To the ugliest girl in our class." There were audible gasps. The mouth dropped open. Some looked down at their desk, seemingly embarrassed for me. "What did you do?" asked a brave soul. "What do you think?" I say. My eyes filled with tears. My nose was stinging, my cheeks burning. I was devastated, and so afraid that he and his friends were watching me, eager to see how I would react. They nod sympathetically. Well, it ruined Valentine's Day for me. It shook what little faith I had in myself for a long time after. But I survived, and now I refuse to cede this holiday of love to the meanness of one rotten boy. Instead, it's given me the motivation to undo the malice of David. I smile. And that's why we're going to have a party. A party that celebrates kindness instead of cruelty. Their eyes light up. They're willing to let me take them wherever I'm going, and I hand out construction paper so they can make mailboxes. You don't have to, but you're welcome to decorate them. I have markers. A few studiously cool boys refuse to do more than just scribble their names. But most students cover theirs with heart swirls and fancy lettering. I can attest that no one has more fun in school than an 18-year-old given permission to be 10 again. The night before the party, I cut pink paper into hundreds of small squares. What are you supposed to write? Someone asked me when I distribute them. Do we have to sign our names? Asked another. Of course you sign your names, I say. You're not going to write anything you're ashamed of, right? The objective is to write something positive and sincere to everyone in the class, even if it's someone you barely know. There's always something nice to say. Admire their fashion sense or their skill at basketball. Remind them of something fun you remember about them from grade school. Looking on as they compose each message is always a treat. I play a mixed CD of oldies and Motown love songs, and the vibe in the room is happy. Feet tap. Sometimes I can't stop myself from dancing. But the real fun comes when they read what people wrote to them. Watching a shy kid tentatively open a card and then break into a big grin is worth all of the hassle. A decade ago, one of my students, Julio, confessed to a girl named Rosa that he'd loved her since the third grade. For months after that, they were a hand-holding, starry-eyed pair. But romances are rare, and not what matters to me. There are four better measures of success. 3 years ago, a boy named Hal wrote me that I was the only one who had noticed when he was depressed. A few months before, and how much it had meant to him. Former students have shared with me that they have hung on to their Valentines and sometimes read through them when they're feeling low. Parents have emailed to tell me that the Valentine exchange boosted their child's self-confidence at a time when it was greatly needed. An especially sweet class had an artistic student draw me a Valentine of a queen with the caption, "To the prettiest girl in the room," and everyone signed it. That one still hangs next to my desk. After 20 years of teaching, I harbor few hopes that students will retain all of their grammar and vocabulary I taught them. Maybe they will remember a book or two with some pleasure, or a fun and creative writing assignment. But if all student recalls of one of my classes are the Valentines they received one long ago February, to me, that makes it all worthwhile. In recent years, the world we inhabit has grown uglier, more divisive and unkind. Today, there are bullies we contend with via social media who are far more powerful and corrosive than the childhood villain I remember so vividly. Add to that the high-stakes push to achieve, to earn A's, to get into the top college that dominates the lives of my current students. And they are left saddled with a level of stress far greater than anything I experienced decades ago. If, for one day a year, I can help them turn all of that off, I can create an environment where they are intentionally kind to one another. Then I count that as something to be proud of. And whatever hurt David intended for me all those years ago, it has now been canceled out many times over. I think he may have been startled by his legacy. The four-legged peacekeeper. My husband and I get along better since realizing how much our yelling upset the dog. First person. And there's a picture of a young woman. Looks like it's probably from the 60s, maybe the 70s. She's got kind of a bouffant hairdo. Pretty green eyes. Gorgeous smile. Very dark hair. Looks like it was probably a class picture. She finally said yes. A lovesick teenager gets the girl 40 years later. One early January day in 1999, 51-year-old Georgine Martin, née Huber, received a delivery of red roses. Her husband had recently passed away, so the flowers didn't seem completely out of the blue. But the name on a note that came with them did. The last place she had seen that name, Jerry Zimmerman, was in her high school yearbook from 1965. "Dear Georgine," Jerry's card read, "I was a classmate of yours. Though I don't believe you knew who I was painfully shy, and you were the prettiest girl I had ever seen." It was true that Georgine hardly remembered Jerry. Nearly four decades had passed since their paths first crossed in the hallway of Farnsworth Junior High in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, where she still lived. "Though I now live in D.C., I keep close tied to Sheboygan," Jerry continued. "I return several times a year, and more to the crux of this letter, I will be visiting the weekend of May 15th. And I'm wondering if we can meet for a coffee. I am, however, sensitive to the recent loss of your husband. If this approach comes too soon, I will understand and wait another 40 years. Why not? Georgine thought to herself as she put down the letter. She was certainly curious to see what Jerry looked like after so many years. If nothing else, it would be nice to just chat with him. She wrote back and agreed to meet with him that spring. In Washington, D.C., Jerry anxiously checked his mailbox each day. When Georgine's reply came, he was elated. She finally said yes. Georgine didn't know it, but she had broken Jerry's heart all those years ago. Obviously, they're going to end up together, and there's a picture of him. He's a very good-looking man. Got a goatee and a mustache and dark hair. And she is tiny. She's very short. She's barely above his shoulder. Still pretty, though. Jerry's interest in Georgine Huber began when he noticed her in ninth grade. Her sparkling eyes gave me a euphoric jolt whenever they glanced obliquely at him. Jerry's shyness prevented him from saying a single word to her until their junior year in high school. A newly minted driver, Jerry was on his way to school one morning when he spotted Georgine walking with a friend. Before he could talk himself out of it, he pulled over and asked the girls whether they wanted a ride. They did. The friends climbed into the front seat, with Georgine sitting next to Jerry. Wonderful days of non-bucket seats. The beautiful girl he had been pining for was sitting just inches away, and it petrified him. Unable to think of anything to say, to break the ice, Jerry didn't even introduce himself. Once at school, his passengers thanked him and went on their way. Jerry spent all day mulling over his next move. His plan was simple. After school, he would drive around until he saw Georgine walking home. Then, just as he had done in the morning, he would offer a ride. She would accept, sit next to him, and that would be that, he thought, happily ever after. When the last bell rang, Jerry raced to the parking lot and started driving around the school. He soon found Georgine walking with the same girl than that morning. Jerry pulled over and rolled the window down. "Fancy another ride?" he asked. Georgine looked at him. "No, we're going to walk." "No?" Jerry couldn't believe it. In his mind, the three of them were already good friends. He slowly rolled the window back up and drove away devastated. It only got worse. The following year, their senior year, he learned that Georgine was engaged. Jerry didn't dare approach her again. After high school, Jerry found work making deliveries for an electrical and plumbing wholesaler. He enjoyed the job until it was sidelined by a back injury in 1983. Jerry, then 36, was forced to do desk work, which he hated. A divorce and the death of his father added to his misery. Then one evening, Jerry opened the Sheboygan Press and saw an ad for the University of Wisconsin. "Do you want to improve your life?" it asked. Intrigued, he read on. The ad advertised a meeting with one of the college's counsel at the local library. By the end of his meeting, Jerry was signed up for two classes. He wasn't totally convinced more schoolwork could help redirect his path, but he really enjoyed his coursework, and he eventually earned a degree in physical geography. Jerry soon left Wisconsin for Spokane, Washington, where he worked as a cartographer in the mapping department for the U.S. Geological Survey. He was later promoted to the U.S. Department of Defense's mapping agency in Washington, D.C. Moving to the nation's capital was a big adjustment. Jerry, who had been raised on a farm, was accustomed to seeing grazing animals in wide open spaces. In D.C., he found himself surrounded by politics and traffic. He missed Wisconsin. He called home every week, and he returned at least twice a year for his birthday in July, and again at Christmas. Usually one of those times, he said, I'd drive by Georgine's house just to get a look. When he would see her out and about, he still couldn't work up the nerve to talk to her. Jerry would look for in the local phone book for her name. It was always there beside her husband's. Jerry married and divorced a second time. Neither of his ex-wives ever knew of his everlasting affection for Georgine, though his friends back home did. On one of his semi-annual visits in December of 1998, Jerry caught up with his friend Frank Cooper. Have you seen Georgine lately? Frank asked. No, not at all, replied. Her husband died. Georgine's husband had succumbed to a brain tumor after being ill with it for nearly a year. All that time, Georgine had been his caretaker. Jerry had to go back to Washington, but before leaving town, he stopped at a local florist. While he didn't want to seem insensitive to Georgine's husband's death, he didn't want to waste any more time. Leaving his shyness behind, he wrote a note to send with the roses. Composing the letter was easy. The difficult part on that cold winter day was squeezing all his warm feeling for her into one little card. When he got back to D.C., Jerry was already looking forward to his next trip home in May. Once he learned that Georgine was interested in getting together, he couldn't wait. He called her that night, and the two spoke for more than an hour. He came over scheduled that spring of 1999 for a brief weekend visit. At 51, he was finally going on his first date with the woman he'd been infatuated with for more than 35 years. Georgine's beauty hadn't faded a bit, and there's another picture of her, and she has gorgeous eyes. Her hair was different, Jerry says, although she was still petite. He was slender himself. The first thing George had said to Joey saw him, Wow, are you skinny? It's perhaps not how Hollywood would have scripted their reunion, but for Jerry and Georgine, the connection was powerful. While Jerry had longed for Georgine for decades, Georgine had been praying for companionship ever since her husband died. If you found something for me, she used to confide in God, I would love that. The two of them had such a great time on their coffee date that they made plans to see each other again when Jerry came back to Washington for a longer visit in July. Jerry was home for 10 days that summer. He spent every one of them with Georgine. The pair took daily walks, usually in a park not far from Lake Michigan. On their third or fourth outing, they decided to stroll along the western banks of the lake instead. The waters were blue, the sounds were gold, Jerry says, and my heart was there, or our hearts, I should say. It was the perfect setting for Jerry to confess the full extent of his feelings. I'm in love with you, he told Georgine. Then he asked her to marry him. It was totally unexpected, Georgine said, but I just knew he was the one. She said yes, and Jerry felt triumphant. He now had two yeses to overcome that no from so long ago. His next trip to Washington was his last. Jerry quit his job with the governor and moved back to Wisconsin. Decades earlier, the most beautiful girl in the world married someone else. That winter, the most beautiful girl in the world married him. Their 24 wedding guests received a version of Georgine and Jerry's love story, 40 years in the making, that Jerry had written. Last year he shared that story with Reader's Digest with this postscript. For several years things were great. Then I developed a limp. Georgine knew what it was, but I needed to hear it from a neurologist. Parkinson's disease. It's now in its advanced stages, but Georgine and I continue to love each other while I battle debilitating symptoms. Moreover, we love the Lord and we're grateful for what he had together, and because it's perfect for us. Happily ever after, indeed. Take 183 years worth of aspirin and New York City's C.O. Bigelow, founded in 1838, isn't just one of the oldest drugstores in the country. Its customers are a who of Americans, from Mark Twain to Eleanor Roosevelt to John Belushi. Interesting. All of those people are dead now. What's that say about the pharmacy? And with that, let's switch over to the Consumer Reports, the best and the worst places to buy furniture. How to find things you'll love whether you're shopping in a store or online, plus Consumer Reports' exclusive ratings of furniture retailers. Oops, let me turn the page or I'm stuck. Okay, the COVID-19 pandemic has forced legions of Americans to spend more time at home. Many of us are using their housebound days to make our surroundings more cozy and attractive. Online home goods sales are up for many retailers, with Wayfair, Williams-Sonoma, the parent company of Pottery Barn and West Elm, and Overstock among those reporting year-over-year increases in U.S. sales revenue for the third quarter. knowing where and how to find the perfect couch, ottoman, or recliner, or bedroom set has rarely been simple. The range of retailers, prices, delivery and return policies, and quality both online and in store can be overwhelming. To help guide your furniture shopping choices, Consumer Reports surveyed more than 38,000 members about their furniture buying experience in their previous 2 years. The survey was done in April 2020 and primarily reflects the pandemic shopping, the pre-pandemic shopping. The resulting ratings of 48 walk-in stores and 17 online retailers, starting on page 40, which we'll get to, can point you in the furniture sellers that are right for you. Whether you decide to head to a store or shop from your current couch, our essential intel will help you find the right piece at the best price and stay safe in the process. Heading to a store. Some people wouldn't think of buying a sofa or a chair without seeing it in person first. Furniture is something that you need to see to believe, says Alan Hussein, a CR member from Sammamish, Washington, who originally bought a bedroom set and furniture for his home office at a room and board store. Our survey results suggest that walk-in furniture stores do a good job of satisfying consumers. Members we polled reported having very positive experiences and 88% of in-store purchases. Why to shop in person? If you're looking for something that needs to be comfortable, like a sofa, there's no way to tell online, says Rachel Alcorn, an interior designer in Wheaton, Illinois, in a store you can stretch out your seat, feel the different types of upholstery, and get a sense of scale of a piece. Personalized attention can be another bonus. More likely than not, a furniture store will have a knowledgeable salesperson who can answer questions about things like fabric durability, says Megan Hedge, an interior designer in Los Angeles, who shops in-store and online for her clients. Potential pitfalls. Some shoppers in our survey said that they were frustrated by the limited selection offered in stores and that the customer service varied widely among retailers. Stickley, Room & Board, and Ethan Allen were among the walk-in stores that won high marks for customer service, while shoppers were less enthusiastic about help offered at Home Goods, IKEA, and Sam's Club. Of course, going to a store means spending time in an enclosed space, which these days could increase your chances of being exposed to the coronavirus. To minimize that risk, there are important precautions you should take. If possible, you should spend no more than 15 minutes in the store, says Ravina Kohler, pharmacist MD, an infectious disease specialist and epidemiologist in Los Angeles. Be sure to wash your hands well or use a hand sanitizer as soon as you can after leaving. To keep your visit as short as possible, call ahead after you get an appointment with a salesperson so that you'll be helped immediately when you arrive. Kohler recommends asking if staff and customers are required to wear masks, if at all times. If not, don't go. And if the store limits capacity, and find out where the store is less likely to be busy, or when the store is less likely to be busy. Success strategies. Browse online ahead of time and bring pictures of the room you're shopping for and the styles you'd like, so the salesperson isn't throwing darts at the wall, says Dallas-based interior designer Julie Oliveira Kular, who uses the strategy herself when furniture shopping recently, says it's another way to minimize your time in a store. Ways to save. When possible, comparison shop online in advance to find out what other stores are charging for the same or similar items. Most independent retailers will price match if asked and are always prepared to negotiate, says General Litwin, the author of Best Furniture Buying Tips Ever. In fact, a third of our survey respondents told us they tried to haggle in-store. Of those, 72% reported success. And I'm going to do an aside here. I happen to know a number of years ago, a gentleman in the furniture business, and he told me that most furniture stores are marking up their inventory 100%, and mainly that's because of the overhead they have to maintain such a large space. Acorn recommends asking about upcoming sales or promotion and whether the store has any online deals that will extend into an in-store purchase. Requesting free delivery is another possible way to save, Oliveira says. Delivery details. Nearly 90% of the in-store furniture purchases mentioned in our survey that were shipped or delivered were white-glove deliveries, which means the furniture was brought in the home, assembled, and placed by the delivery team, as opposed to being left in a box at the curb. White-glove delivery usually costs extra, generally between $60 and $400, depending on factors, like the price of the furniture and your home's proximity to the store. Curbside delivery may be available free, but you'll need to get furniture into your house or apartment yourself and assemble it if necessary. You'll probably have to sign a form acknowledging receipt of the delivery, inspect the furniture carefully while the delivery team waits, and don't accept it if there's a defect or other problem. The store may not accept a return if you do. Dealing with returns. Before you buy, find out the return window, which can vary widely, and whether you have to pay return shipping fees. Also, find out if the store will provide a full refund or store credit only. Even if you don't have to pay for return shipping, you may be charged a restocking fee, typically of 10 to 20% of the sale price. Some stores don't accept return at all, usually for custom-made items that most won't refund a customer's original delivery fees. Shopping online. While you can't test out a sofa or a chair before you buy it online, 85% of our survey respondents who shopped online reported they were very or completely satisfied, on a par with those who shopped in-store. I brought my couch, chair, and ottoman online, says Nancy Stilwell, a CR member in Madison, Wisconsin. It made me nervous, but I couldn't find what I wanted in local stores, so I shopped online, and my gamble paid off. Why to shop online? The variety of styles, colors, and models available are vast. For example, a recent search on Amazon for a pink sofa, not likely the most popular color choice, returned more than 9,000 results. If you have something specific and unusual in mind, chances are you'll be able to find it online. You may also be able to find the same item sold at several different online retailers, which could allow you to save money by price shopping. Potential pitfalls. It's difficult to determine quality or durability from online images and descriptions. Be careful if you're unsure of a brand's quality, says Sarah Chawat, an interior designer in Short Hills, New Jersey. She advises looking closely at an item's measurements and descriptions, reading reviews from verified buyers, and investing as much as your budget allows. You often get what you pay for, she says. But even buying from a retailer you know and paying top dollar won't guarantee you'll be happy with the purchase if you don't do your research. I ordered a pair of $1,300 sofas online from West Elm, and when they came, the seats weren't as deep as they looked in the pictures, says Litwin, the furniture shopping expert. She hadn't checked the dimensions before ordering. Shame on her. I was able to return them, but West Elm didn't refund my original shipping and charged me a 10% restocking fee. About the same mistake by measuring your existing furniture to note the dimensions that are comfortable for your body, and double-check the dimensions of anything you purchase online. Success strategies. Use the tools online retailers offer, such as detailed measurement and specification information, and the customer service and design teams who can answer questions via chat, email, or phone. Some retailers, including Crate & Barrel and Pottery Barn, employ designers who will meet with you online to create a floor plan at no charge. Ways to save. Most of the strategy recommended when shopping in a walk-in store hold true online. Comparison shop, and ask customer service about upcoming sales, special discount codes, and free shipping offers. You can often save on your first order by signing up for the company's promotional emails. You can also email a site's chat feature to ask for a discount. 80% of CR survey respondents who did this were offered a lower price. Delivery details. Furniture retailers with in-store and online shopping usually deliver via white glove service for both and for about the same fee, depending on the cost of the order and your location. Amazon, Overstock, Wayfair, and other online retailers often offer standard shipping or curbside delivery free. CR members in our survey who bought the furniture online weren't as happy with the quality of the delivery service as in-store buyers were. Just 17% of the online purchases reported by our members came via white glove delivery for some majority of in-store purchases, so it may be worth paying extra for the convenience of white glove delivery if it's offered. It's especially convenient for large items and those that require assembly. Some retailers offer an assembly service, sometimes by an outside company. For an additional fee that may vary by item, IKEA, for example, bases assembly fees starting at $18 on the cost of the item and may charge an additional $35 for someone to come to your home. Dealing with returns. Most online retailers have generous return windows during which you can return item undamaged and with a receipt for a full refund, but returning an item can be a real chore. You may have to repack it and pay return shipping charges, which can be substantial. If the item arrived damaged or missing parts, you typically don't have to pay to return it, and the company will even send a delivery to your home to remedy the problem. Always open the box and inspect the goods before you sign for delivery, and keep all the packaging until you're sure you're satisfied. Some online stores require customers to return items unassembled and in the original packing. Quality is in the details. Here are some things to look for when reading furniture descriptions and questions to ask while talking to a customer service rep or a salesperson. Upholstered furniture, construction. A kiln-dried hardwood frame with an 8-way hand-tied spring is tops in quality. Less expensive webbing support can be comfortable but tends to stretch out over time. Plywood platform support is the least expensive and the least comfortable. Cushions. The best are filled entirely with down, real or synthetic, or, for more support, have a foam core wrapped with a down or synthetic down. Less expensive seating will have all foam cushions, which may look very square and blocky. Fabric. Its fabric starts out to pill or stains easily. You'll hate the sofa or chair long before it wears out, said Joanna Oliveira, an interior designer in Dallas. The most durable fabrics are commercial-grade performance, or indoor-outdoor, she says. Blends made with polyester are usually more durable, easier to clean, and less expensive than all cotton or all linen upholstery. Leather. Extremely soft top grain leather can stain easily and may rot, may not be the best choice for dining chairs or households with young children. For the look of leather without the high price and upkeep, manufactured versions like bonded leather or leather gel, essentially leather in straps and together with glue or polyurethane, may be easier to maintain. Wood furniture. Construction. Many people think solid wood is best, but wood veneer can be more affordable and work well for bookshelves and other large solid pieces. Joints. Dovetail joints are strongest, but furniture with butt joints, which are glued, can stand up well and cost less. Finish. Surfaces should be smooth and finishes even. For dining room tables and other heavily used pieces, a catalyzed conversion varnish will be more resistant to wear than a lacquer top coat. Before you buy, make sure it fits. Measure all the doorways and hallways that the furniture will have to pass through to be delivered to your home. The websites of many furniture retailers provide detailed instructions about measuring, and that kind of made a mistake when I buy a sofa. It's a little bigger than I thought it was. Request samples. Many stores and online retailers will send you swatches of fabric and sometimes furniture finishes, often for free. Study the online images. Look at all of the images a retailer posts of the furniture you consider buying, then check its social media accounts to see if there are pictures of the furniture in customers' homes. Zoom in on details like upholstery seams to make sure they're straight and neatly finished. Read the reviews. Pay attention to common complaints, such as the color being brighter or darker in real life than it is looks online for a piece being hard to assemble. Check the warranty. 1-year warranty is standard, but doesn't cover wear and tear, which may be a gray area. Ratings and reviews from the Better Business Bureau may indicate a retailer's willingness to work out problems. Pull up a chair. Six popular retailers compared. Here's a closer look at how prices, policies, and products vary among furniture sellers. Refer to our ratings chart, which we'll look at to see how these retailers and others did in our survey. The first one we got is Amazon. River Frederick chair, priced $484.20. What you get? Velvet upholstery, foam seat, some assembly required. Delivery. Doorstep delivery is free with Amazon Prime. In-home delivery is available on some items for $19.99. Returns. Return within 30 days for a refund. In most cases, return shipping is free or Amazon will schedule a pickup. Warranty. Amazon brands carry a minimum 1-year warranty. For other brands, the warranty varies from manufacturer to manufacturer. Good to know. Almost an unlimited selection. Costco. Walls chair. And it's a pair for $218.99. Available online only at Costco.com. What you get? Polyester upholstery fabric, foam seat, some assembly required. Delivery. Some items are available in warehouses. More items are available on Costco.com. Prices include delivery. Returns. They're accepted anytime for a full refund. Charge large items ordered online may be picked up at the customer's home for no additional charge. Warranty. Costco offers a risk-free 100% satisfaction guarantee. Good to know. Can shop in-store or online, but must be a member to make a purchase, which is $80 per year. RH, Restoration Hardware, it's a regional chain. A regional chair, 1,571 to 2,998. What you get? Italian textures, weave fabric, feather down, foam seat, fully assembled. Delivery. White glove delivery in the contiguous U.S. for $199, $599, depending on distance from the nearest RH gallery. Returns. Contact RH within 30 days of the delivery date. Round-trip shipping is refunded if the item is defective or damaged. RH will pick up the large pieces. Warranty. No official policy, but RH says it stands behind its products. It's good to know. Shop online or in-store. Design help and a 25% discount are perks of a $100 annual membership. Room and board. A Quinn chair. Prices is $7,999 up. What you get? Performance fabric, fiber-wrapped foam cushions, fully assembled. Delivery. White good delivery in the contiguous U.S. for $79. Returns. A full refund for timely returns. Damaged or worn items may be refused or result in an adjustment. Return shipping is refunded. Original delivery fees are not. Pickup may be arranged for large items. Warranty. No official policy. Room and board says it will work with customers to resolve any problems. Good to know. Buy in-store or online. There are extensive customer service options, including free design services. Sam's Club. Harlow Chair and Ottoman Set. What you get? Chair and ottoman stain-resistant fabric, fully assembled. Delivery. Free shipping on many items. White good delivery and limited, and the cost varies by item. Returns. They're accepted any time. No charges for return shipping. Items purchased in-store must be returned there. Sam's Club may arrange a pickup for any return of any large item. Warranty. Varies by item. Sam's Club has a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Good to know. Shop in-store or online. Membership is required, which is $45 per year. Stickley, a walnut grove chair. Price is $2,695. What you get? Solid American black walnut covered in fabric or leather. Delivery. Each Stickley retailer has an exclusive individual policy. Warranty related returns only. Warranty. A limited warranty guarantees against structural defects during the lifetime of the original owner. Good to know. In-store shopping only. Many Stickley retailers offer complimentary interior design services. Okay, here are the ratings, and I'm not going to go to in all the details, but I will run down the list of what they're checking on. They're checking on quality, customer service, on-time delivery, quality of delivery, policies, communications, website usability, price paid, selection, returns, and in-store atmosphere. And the number one is Stickley. The room and board is second. Costco is third. Independent retailers are third or fourth. Then there's Jordan's Fisher, Scandinavian Designs, Nebraska Furniture Mart, Bayer's Furniture, Ethan Allen, R.C. Wiley Home Furnishing, Crate and Barrel, Cost Plus World Market, Macy's, Bassett Furniture, American Warehouse, Living Spaces, Staples, Home Goods, Haverty's, Restoration Hardware, IKEA, Steinhoffels, Furniture Row, Slumberland Furniture, Target, Pottery Barn, Office Depot, Lazy Boy Furniture Galleries, Raymore and Flanagan, Lowe's, Kane's Furniture, Big Lots, Star Furniture, and Our House. And these all got good ratings in the 80s. Value City Furniture, Bad Rock Home Furniture, Levin Furniture, Bob's Discount, and Home Depot. And now we get into the ones that aren't quite as good. Sam's Club, West Elm, Jerome's Furniture, City Furniture, Rooms to Go, Mathis Brothers, Walmart, and Ashley Furniture Products. Online, the highest rated are Room and Board, Costco, and Restoration Hardware. The following ones are in the 80s score as well. Amazon.com, Independent Retailer, Sam's Club, Pottery Barn, Macy's, Warefare, Target, Home Depot, Crate and Barrel, Overstock.com, IKEA, West End, and Walmart, and Ashley Furniture Home Store got the lowest rating with a 78. Eat healthier even during a pandemic. COVID-19 has changed the way many of us eat. Here's how to incorporate nutritious and delicious food into your new normal. And there's pictures of a smoothie, which is called a super smoothie, vitamin-rich leafy greens, boost nutrition. Try kale with pineapple or spinach with blueberries. Ooh, that sounds kind of gross. And there's a bowl full of strawberries. And on a sweet note, Delicious fresh berries are packed with immune-strengthening vitamin C and antioxidants. It's okay to top them with a little frozen yogurt or ice cream for an occasional treat. And then there's a plate with strawberries and looks like scrambled eggs. Eggs for dinner, inexpensive and protein-packed. Eggs make a meal a quick, easy meal. Consider scrambling some instead of getting takeout. There are a few aspects of our lives that COVID-19 hasn't affected, but one of the most fundamental shifts in how it has promoted many of us to practically reinvent what, where, and how we eat. There's no doubt Americans' relationship with food has been transformed, says Jane Manwheeler, who led two recent nationally representative surveys at Consumer Reports that addressed eating habits and food shopping patterns, each involving more than 2,000 American adults. At the pandemic start, many of us stumbled into a new way of life that necessitated eating every meal at home with just those who live there. About 80% of the Americans say they made at least one change in the food they eat on the way they source or prepare it. See our surveys found. Initially, we all viewed these changes as stopgaps, but as the weeks turned into months, we realized we developed new patterns that could have lasting consequences. Like everything about this pandemic, different groups have been affected in various, often unequal ways. Jagdish Kulbanchanilandi, Ph.D., a professor at New Mexico State University and lead author of a study on U.S. eating practices during the pandemic, says some people are doing extremely well and others are declining in their health. For every person who is cooking more or growing their own food, there's another who is relying on takeout. While many are enjoying more family meals, others are coping with dining solo. According to CR survey, people are snacking, stress eating, and eating comfort foods more often. 32% of the people say they've gained weight, and 50% say they've lost some. More Americans are touched by food insecurity. The percentage of people using a food pantry or food bank rose from 12% before the pandemic to 19%, and I bet it's higher than that now. And the crisis has widened the socioeconomic divide, Kubachandiani says. Many people who can work from home don't spend much time on a commute now. They maintain their jobs and have more control over their life, so their diet habits have actually improved. But he says, but people who lost their jobs may not have access to good food now. Yet eating well, especially vital at this time, given that obesity, heart disease, and diabetes all increase the risk of COVID-19 complications. So almost a year after the pandemic, this is a good time to evaluate your diet and see which habits you need to keep and which could be rethought. We talked with people who have experienced food shifts and asked nutritionists how to make these new eating patterns as healthy and enjoyable as possible. Pre-pandemic, Emor Campbell, who happens to be a black lady from North Carolina, a wedding planner in Charlotte, North Carolina, was a customer's dinners out, happy hour drinks, and frequent travel. But once the single 29-year-old realized she'd be steering clear of restaurants, bars, and airplanes for a while, she decided to overhaul her approach to food shopping and cooking. I'm a down south girl, so I know how to fry some chicken, and I can make a mean potato salad, Campbell says. But now I'm expanding, taking it up a notch, taking a range of recipe things that my mother never made, like beef bourguignon and soy mushroom burgers. At the same time, she wanted to be able to prepare foods that would support her immune system and keep her fit and do so without breaking the bank. I've always liked fresh fruit and vegetables, but now I want to get as many nutrients as I can, she says. So she invested in a juicer, which she packs with a variety of fruits and vegetables, and an air fryer so that she can cook chicken wings, fish, and meatballs with less fat. Campbell says she's looking forward to showing off her new cooking skills after the pandemic. I want to be known for making great meals for my family and friends. How to find your inner chef. There are many benefits to cooking at home, says Emma Letting, Ph.D., director of dietetics at the University of Georgia. It can give you more control over the ingredients, and it can be soothing to engage all of your senses in a purposeful activity. To make most of home cooking, try these tips. Buy extra and freeze. Many foods can be frozen, so put your freezer to work. For example, freeze berries and grapes on a cookie sheet lined with wax paper or parchment, then place in an airtight container in the freezer. Blanch veggies in boiling water, then run under cold water before freezing in an airtight container. Plan your meals. Campbell says she's taken to perusing recipes online and planning meals for the week so that she can take fewer supermarket trips while making her food budget go farther. Buy in bulk. To keep prices down, Campbell says she buys some groceries with a friend. It's much more affordable to buy a family-sized package of meat or chicken or a big bag of broccoli and split it, she says. Cook once, eat twice. Make double or triple portions so you can have several servings of a healthy meal. Dishes like vegetable soup, chili, pizza, and lasagna freeze well. Divide into one or two servings so that you can pull out with only what you need. Shanika Williams didn't have much time to stock up on groceries for her family of five when the stay-at-home orders went into effect in her hometown of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I did my regular shopping, but after a week or so, we needed more food, and we were hesitant to go to the store. Plus, convenience was key. The 32-year-old, who runs her own marketing agency, and her husband were working from home while remote schooling their daughters ages 11, 8, and 5, so they were short on time and motivation to cook well-rounded meals. The family got into the habit of ordering in, often choosing pizzas, fried chicken, anything that was satisfying, Williams says. For snacks, she opted for other easy options so that she wouldn't have to stop every time the kids got hungry. It was what the kids would grab and eat on their own, she says. Chips, ice cream, cheese sticks, and donuts became the norm. Without the constant pressure to cook, the family did have time to hang out and bond, Williams says. But after several months, Williams saw a downside, too. In August, we noticed that we were gaining weight, and we were out of shape, she says. I felt unhealthy, and the kids were literally snacking all day long. So Williams instituted family exercise time, including walks, bike rides, and backyard trampoline sessions. She also decided to gradually change the family's eating habits. We tried to make more of a lifestyle change as a diet, because I can never stick to a diet, Williams says. Instead of all those chips, I went to farmer's market and bought a lot of produce. I might buy a bag of chips now, but when it's gone, it's gone. Williams made other substitutions that didn't require a lot of time and effort. She ordered in less and cooked more grilled chicken and fish. She traded regular pastas for noodles made of cauliflower or zucchini and swapped ice cream for yogurt smoothies topped with fruit and granola. Instead of juice boxes, she invested in a water cooler. The efforts paid off. She and her husband are getting back in shape, and their daughters adapted surprisingly easy to eating more whole foods. It helps that her girls don't realize they're eating veggie noodles, not traditional pasta. They've even started to enjoy cooking themselves. Now if the kids want pizza, we'll make it together in a healthier way, Williams says. CR's advice, how to curb mindless eating. In CR's survey, 22% of people said they were eating healthier now than they were a year ago, but almost a third reported weight gain, and in that group, 37% said their eating habits had worsened. As the Williamses experienced, spending so much time at home with the fridge only steps away can be blur boundaries around food, says Lisa Young, Ph.D., a nutrition and food studies expert at New York University. When people have less structure in their day and more access to the kitchen, it leads to more snacking and nibbling, she says. Though it can be hard to change and adapt new habits, a little planning can help. Create a schedule that includes general times for three meals and one or two snacks to keep everyone in check. Post a schedule and maybe even set a timer for the kids. Knowing when you'll be eating again can fend off the urge to snack on empty calories. Make it easier to grab a healthy snack. Put together individual snack packs in advance, preferably with some protein, carbs, and fat, which can help to keep you full. Don't use takeout as an excuse to eat unhealthy food. Order dishes with lean protein, plenty of vegetables, and whole grains. If you just can't bypass more divulgent fare, get one decadent dish to share and round out the meal with healthier picks. Go for the small pizza, for example, and also order a salad, grilled fish, and sautéed vegetables. Serve everyone a portion of each dish. Plan your treats. I call it delay, don't deprive. Young says, knowing that you're going to get your coveted food at an appointed time in the day, depriving yourself completely backfires, she says, because it often leads to overindulgence at the wrong time. Healthy snacks to keep on hand. Snacking, comfort food, desserts, eating more of all these during the pandemic has upended many healthy diets, but it doesn't have to be that way. In fact, between meal eating can actually be good for you if you do it right. Eating better overall can mean the difference between feeling energetic or fatigued and between strengthening or weakening your immune system, says Amy Keating, a registered dietitian at Consumer Reports. Fruits and vegetables are always a great option, But when you want something a little more indulgent rather than downing potato chips, consider these nutritious snack ideas from CR's food and diet experts. Popcorn. It's better to pop your own, but bagged options could be good if you choose one with more than 50 milligrams of sodium, no more than 50 milligrams of sodium, and 3 grams of fat per cup. Angie's Boom Chicka Pop Sea Salt. CR's testers said it has a nice toasted corn flavor and crumpy, crispy, crunchy flavor. Nuts. Eating a handful of nuts a day can help protect against heart disease and type 2 diabetes. Any unsalted nut will do. Woodstock roasted and unsalted almonds are slightly fruity and have a natural sweetness. Nut butter. A slice of whole grain toast or an apple with nut butter is a satisfying snack. Choose one that has no additional sodium or sugars, like Kirkland Signature from Costco Creamy Almond Butter. Energy bars. Look for nuts and dried fruit as the main sources of protein and fiber, not protein from soy isolates, rice, or peas, or fiber from chicory root or corn. Larabar Blueberry Muffin fits the bill and is tasty, too. Yogurt. Probiotics, protein, calcium, potassium, and magnesium make yogurt one of the best snacks in CR's yogurt test. Icelandic Provisions 1.5% milk fat traditional Sky Vanilla yogurt came out on top of the ratings and is among the product's lowest in added sugars. Dark chocolate. A little dark chocolate is a nice treat, and a higher cacao content means less sugars and more antioxidants. Look for at least 70% cacao, like Trader Joe's 72% cacao, top-rated in CR's test for its complex flavor. Half a bar is just 6 grams of added sugar. Granola. Look for Simply flavors and helpful whole ingredients, such as nuts, dried fruit, and oats, like you'll find at Bare Naked Fruit and Nut Granola. Legume snacks. Legume chips and puffs are higher in protein and fiber than potato or corn chips. That may make them more satisfying, so you eat fewer of them. 1 ounce Harvest Snaps Green Pea Snack, crisp, lightly salted, has 5 grams of each. And crackers. Triscuit Original Thin Crisp are 100% whole grain and reasonably low in sodium, 100 milligrams per serving. Just what you want in a cracker. And frozen yogurt. Froyo can have a cleaner ingredients list than many diet ice creams. CR's taste testers say Blue Bunny Vanilla Bean Frozen Yogurt has a big vanilla and dairy flavors for 140 calories and 14 grams of sugar per two-thirds of a cup. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-518. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.